Listen to this. See if this doesn't sound like home. Australia's Aborigines give modern man a hint of how his ancestors lived. Do you know about the men who lived back out way back in Australia? The Aborigines? The Europeans emerged from the old Stone Age about 10,000 years ago. Many Aborigines are still in it. Do you understand what this means, really? This does not mean they're behind the times. No, it goes a little further than that. That they are living in a period, it would be as if somebody had somehow been able to fence off one block in Brooklyn. If you can imagine somebody right in the middle of Brooklyn, some wealthy man, fences off one square mile in Brooklyn, puts a big high fence around it in the year 1867. And the people inside this square block of Brooklyn, square mile, continue to live just exactly the way they lived in 1867. Because nothing comes from the outside. And only can civilization move forward if it's going to move at all. If things seep in from all directions, from east, west, north, south, everywhere, this great big pot of whatever it is that we're living in. But once something gets isolated, like those carrots at the bottom of a chili pot, they remain carrots. And could you imagine a section of Brooklyn living as if they lived in 18, exactly the same way, the same clothing, the same speech, the same manner of addressing one another, and the same manner of worship, everything, right down to, they were 1867 people. Well, all the way outside the walls, people continue to go. The Yankees win the pennant. The Brooklyn Dodgers move out. And these people don't even know about the Brooklyn Dodgers or any of this. They just continue to live in their cube. And once in a while, something goes overhead. Something flies over, an airplane. And one of the natives, two of the natives see it, and they wonder, what is that? It's a funny bird. They see it go over, and they hear it hum. It's a loud one. They just let it go past because they know nothing about it. Well, if you can go back 10,000 years, where man was hardly even man at that time, here you have them, and they really are living that way. They're not just behind the times. They are not in the times or of the times. It's a very different thing. Yes. Their simple hunting and food-gathering economy suggests the hardships that Europeans knew thousands of years ago. But how can we say hardship? That's ridiculous. Does a man miss an airplane who has never been in one? Who doesn't know they exist? This is an interesting problem. We like to ascribe hardship to people who do not have what we have on the assumption that they secretly want to be what we are, always. Good old European man. The supreme egotism of it all. The Arunta, tribesmen, inhabit the very center of the world's smallest continent. Anthropologist Edward Weyer calls them as perfect an example of a Stone Age people as we have today. Physically, they may be closer than any other living people to Neanderthal man, a resident of Europe 50,000 years ago. The Arunta have lithe, well-proportioned bodies, chocolate-brown complexions, and long, flowing beards. They wear no clothing and build no shelter. They live entirely in the open. In fact, a family's entire possessions may wear no more than 30 pounds. The nomadic tribesmen lack metal, agriculture, pottery, the wheel, numbers, writing, and domestic animals. They know none of these. I repeat, metals, agriculture, pottery, agriculture. Do you realize how far back that goes? You know, one of the great big changes in man's history came when man stopped running around and chasing things and stopped and said, let's try this. And took something and put it in the ground. And it came out and he said, let's stay here. That was a tremendous discovery. They haven't made it yet, these people. They do not know the wheel. Wandering constantly, and listen to this beautiful description of them. Wandering constantly across an area of moon-like desolation in search of food and water. The Arunta eat anything that lives, from emus and snakes to bugs and spiders. For candy, they dig up honey ants and bite off the nectar-filled abdomens. In the rainy season, they run after rain squalls and drink up the puddles as fast as they find them. In the dry season, they dig deep into soaks for wet sand. They sleep naked, always, and live naked in freezing weather. To learn the secret of their hardiness, the U.S. team of naval research sent out a group of scientists from the University of Pennsylvania. The Aborigines were found to have an inborn ability to tolerate intense body cooling. Observers have reported the Aborigines have many tiny tricks to withstand cold. Husband, wife, and children sleep in a tight ball, all intertwined. During the night, they roll into the warm ashes of their fires and sleep there. Sleepers also snuggle up to their dogs. A chilly night rates as a three-dog night. A five-dog night is a real gasser. And doesn't this sound like home? To make up for lack of material goods, Aborigines lead an extraordinarily rich spiritual life. Their religion focuses on countless gods and demons. Some ceremonies are so sacred that a comprehensive sign language is used to avoid even a whisper of interruption. The men can converse soundlessly for hours. They do not believe that serious illness, accident, or death result from natural causes. Instead, they attribute misfortunes to black magic or the work of enemies. You see why anthropologists study ancient cultures? They learn about us. In the event of death, an inquest is held to determine the murderer. Rituals identify the culprit. When accused, however, the culprit and his relatives generally find some peaceful means to settle the account. When the Europeans arrived in Australia, about 300,000 tribesmen inhabited the continent. The early settlers considered the Aborigines a nuisance, and the natives retreated steadily before the newcomers' cruelty and diseases. Today, probably 50,000 survive. And recently, their number has begun to increase as they wander desolately across their desert of moon-like desolation in search of food and water, eating anything that lives, from emus and snakes to bugs and spiders. It is so tough there. This is one thing that the anthropologist who wrote this piece did not say. It is so tough that they have no time for war. There is a guy who writes for the New York Times, whom I've never met, I don't know anything about him, who is very rapidly becoming my favorite writer in the Times. This guy has a sinister sense of defeat. And it is very unusual that you run into a writer in the New York, any kind of a paper. And interestingly enough, most of the writers who become favorite writers in newspapers are generally the writers who write the most obvious sort of things. I've noticed this happen time and time again. For example, people who write things about the most unusual character I met yesterday. That kind of, that's a surefire. The New York Times has always had two or three guys who write these odd little character things, which are not odd at all, but very standard, very traditional. The man who makes his living by collecting old flowers, you know, this kind of thing. The river, how they clean up the river in the morning. And a visit to Yankee Stadium in the winter, that sort of thing. Well, they're all right, but this is the most obvious of things. But listen to this story. And nobody ever says anything about this writer. I have never heard anyone even refer to him over at the Times. When Gordon Peary, and the story is Dateline Paris, October 30th, when Gordon Peary, the world record holder at 3,000 meters, ran as an amateur last summer, he received, he says, up to $200 a race in under-the-table payments. Yesterday, running as a pro in a bull ring in San Sebastian, Spain, the 30-year-old Englishman receives, he says, $800 in cash on the line. The money was better this time, but everything else was worse. The track, a line scratched into the sand of the bull arena, was circular and measured 100 yards around. The race was at 10,000 meters. Do you know how far 10,000 meters is? Well, you can figure a meter is roughly 3 feet. 10,000 meters. That's a good race. 100 laps of the arena, a circle scratched in the sand, 100 yards around. 100 laps. 6 miles of unchanging scenery, blurred red of the arena wall, blurred yellow of the sand, blurred faces of the crowd. 6 miles in the sand, round and around. For half an hour, Peary ran round and round that perfect circle, always leaning in, always slightly off balance, his weight always on one side. The blurred, unchanging scenery hypnotized him. The rolling gait and the sandy footing murdered his feet. Blisters formed. Halfway through, he shed the nail of a big toe. But he ran on. His opposition? Two Spaniards, neither of whom had ever been heard of in track and field. Chiquito de Ariz is a shepherd from the hills. The other was Miguel Aldez, a professional distance runner, whatever that means. Ariz ran first. Aldez relieved him at 5,000 meters. Two men running against Peary. One would run the first half of the race, the other would run the second. And at 5,000 meters, Aldez relieved Ariz. By sprinting his final 100 yards, Ariz was able to pass Peary and was leading by about 35 yards when Aldez took over. The two Spaniards had planned on cracking Peary's morale. Peary had run 3 miles. His feet were killing him and his breath came hard. Then Ariz sprinted to finish, and Aldaz sprinted to start. Peary suddenly found himself 60 yards behind Aldaz, who was fresh. Peary did not have a chance of catching him. Peary's stuff was slowly ebbing away. And sitting at the sidelines, his staff, his wife, Shirley, his only helper. She was his only support. The grandstand was frantic with cheerers for the other two men. Shirley was the only one that was crying for Peary. The crowd numbered 5,000 or less. Bookmakers scamped about, shouting odds, taking bets, changing money. When the race started, the odds were 5-4 on Peary. They dropped finally to 1-5. Betting finally went at no odds at all. 500 yards from the end, they stopped betting completely. By then, Aldaz was coasting. Peary had nothing left. Ariz, the shepherd, ran his 5,000 meters in 15 minutes, 9 seconds. Aldaz, the professional, was clocked at 15:58. Peary's time was 31:22. The world record for 10,000 meters at 28:18 is held by a Soviet Union runner. he was just 2 minutes over the world record. But that, of course, was run on a good track, the world record, with all proper form being observed. Pitti was running on sand and by himself. The Spaniards were said to have been paid about $800 each, although this seems a bit high. Peary, a member of every British Olympic team since 1952, had been the enfant terrible of British track, a great runner when he chose to be, but a problem in all else, outspoken always about meet organizers, coaches, under-the-table payments, and his own skill. He was part of the scandal that broke in Sweden last summer. Peary and a Swedish runner and other runners were accused of professionalism. Peary was suspended by his track federation, and he then talked about amateurism, claiming that all top athletes took money and that most race organizers were hypocrites. He wrote an article in the British Weekly to this effect. British reaction was that all of this might be true, but talking about it isn't in good form. Certainly true, but we don't believe in this sort of thing. Just talking. Peary then announced he planned to start a professional track troupe modeled after Jack Cramer's pro tennis troupe. He went to Barcelona and talked with Cramer during the Cramer Cup matches there earlier this month. Apparently, Cramer paid his expenses for several days, and it was murmured that Cramer would back him. But Cramer announced that although Peary was a very nice man, he declined to get involved in pro track right now. So, Peary came to San Sebastian alone, and the two Spaniards ran him into the ground. One disgusted spectator left the arena muttering, "I have seen bullfighters run faster in this arena than Peary did." After the race, Peary limped out of the bullfighters' infirmary under the arena, which had served as dressing room, and remarked, "Of course, I'm disappointed in today's result, but I feel the experiment deserves to be continued. I still hope to form a troupe of pro stars which will appear all over Europe. There is much money to be made." And then he climbed into his red Volkswagen with his wife Shirley and rode away. Let me tell you, that is a powerful story. Now, I don't know why a story like that has the sort of effect that it often does on people who, to begin with, was he defeated? Was he? Hard to say. And to even go further than that, I'll say this one thing about European sports. And you know, it's quite often that we in America feel that we are barbarous people. I think it's because it's been told to us for 200 years by everybody, ranging from de Tocqueville to Charles Dickens. Any person who comes to these shores and who returns to England or France or wherever it is that he's come from, it is almost, well, it's accepted form to then lecture and to write on the continent about the barbaric Americans. And on the other hand, it is accepted form for anyone who comes here within 15 minutes to be on every national television show to tell us what's wrong with American men, what's wrong with American this, and what's wrong with American that. And we love it. We want this. And we also not only want it, but we all agree that whatever he has said is true, which is even more interesting. Now, this man here, this runner, I can say this, that in Europe, my little experience with the European sports scene, there are more barbaric things, truly barbaric, barbarous, really, in the deepest sense of the word, than I have can even consider ever happening here. Now, can you imagine us running a man this way around a track against two other men, spelling him at halfway, and a crowd of 5,000 people screaming for the two men? You can't imagine it. And then on top of it, all of them betting as he runs around and yelling and screaming at him. And then after he has run and has lost only by about a minute and a half, well, 60 yards or so he lost to these two men, somebody says, "I have seen bullfighters run better in this ring." Fantastic. The strange insight into And I believe this. I believe that you can tell a great deal about a nation by looking at its sporting events. You really can. And about a whole people. The other night, I'm listening to Moscow Radio, and the announcer who was on, and by the way, their announcers never sound English. They all sound very much American. They all have American accents. He said yesterday afternoon, the Soviet team from Leningrad, the Soviet football team, played the Birmingham Raiders from Birmingham, England. And our glorious, wonderful compatriots defeated the team from Birmingham, England, by superior sportsmanship and also by superior team play, once again proving that team play is far better than the individualistic sort of play that the capitalist people put on the field as so-called sporting men. Well, now that tells you a great deal about what they believe, you see, and it has nothing to do with sport, really. I mean, on the surface, but genuinely it does. And I can't get the picture out of my mind of this man running around the track with his toenail torn off. Running around the track, leaning in. Listen to this description of it. Have you ever run fast down a street? Have you ever run fast yourself? Really? Most adults hardly ever do. And listen to this description. For a half an hour, Peary ran round and round and round, always leaning in, always slightly off balance, his weight always on one side. The blurred, unchanging scenery hypnotized him. Blurred red of the arena wall moving past, blurred yellow of the sand, and the blurred faces of the crowd, and the screams of the spectator all cheering for his opponents. Wow, that's a beautiful, beautiful description of a nightmare. Running in a hostile world, a completely hostile world, just running, 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 with the whole crowd cheering for the other people. And the other people are relaying one after the other. One after the other, they're relaying each other. They're helping each other. One after the other, they move in and out. And throw in another one. You run and run and run. And the red and the yellow and the green and the blue and the purple and all of it is going past you. Oh, I'm going to get there. I have heard. Oh, I've seen. Oh, run, run. I have known better bullfighters than this man. Running. Oh, run, run. Oh, you run like an old lady. Run, run. Oh, boy, what a description of the average career. Like this friend of mine, I ran into him the other day, and I have been watching him very closely, because about 3 years ago, he got the bug. And the bug was to get out there where there is green fields. You know, we all have nostalgia about fields and space, and he wanted to get out there in the space. Speaking of the running of the career and the blurred sand and the wild blues and greens of the crowd, he finally did it. He moved way up to Westchester, and he was deliriously happy for a while. And then he stopped talking about it. And today it finally happened. I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "Well, I don't know. I don't know. All of a sudden, I can't stand any of the people who keep coming over. And I used to think they were great people. They're my friends." Just suddenly, in the middle of a sentence, "I can't stand them." I said, "What do you mean? They're nice people, aren't they?" "Yeah, but..." And he was just nearing, I would suspect, about lap 98. And they have just, again, thrown in another team on him. Another team. Another crowd. And the whole world is cheering for the winners. And you guess who are the winners? Huh. Hello, winner. Yeah. Put her there, Dad. Yes, I'll meet you down at the boat. Yeah. You know, what you gotta do is learn to swim on your back. That's right. Oh, of course. Some people believe in taffy apples. I understand that. Oh, if you save... No, it's old gold packages, you save. They've got the number in them. And it's Wrigley gum wrappers you save for the Fords. That's right. There's a number inside that. Yeah, that's right. Wrigley gum wrappers. That's it. And if you get the nickel that has the D upside down under the picture of the Indian, it's worth $4.5 million. $4.5 million. You'll be immediately rich. So, there's no place you can get a good taffy apple. You're right. There's not a good taffy apple place in town. I figure, well, the way I look at it, I figure Mrs. Brenner was right. Those are true stories. I'll tell you, though, the funny thing about what Mr. Brenner did when he came home and found the guy who lived upstairs, he just says, well, look, I'll go upstairs. What he did. He just didn't come down. In fact, they stayed like that for a week. Mrs. Brenner didn't care.